Glimpses of Eternity, the first work to explore shared death experiences, common but mysterious experiences of family and friends sharing a loved one's journey from this life to the next. Of course, Dr. Raymond Moody with us, and we're going to be talking with him about this along with Dr. John Turner right here on Coast to Coast AM. And both of our guests have been on the program before. Of course, the esteemed Dr. Raymond Moody. He is the foremost expert on the phenomenon of near-death experiences, as well as a compelling lecturer on the subjects of evocation of the deceased, cult activities, out-of-body experiences, and the paranormal. Here's Dr. Raymond Moody. Raymond, how are you? Welcome back.
All right, George. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
To hear you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this tonight. And
Me too.
Of course, we've got John Turner with us, serving as the first neurosurgeon on the Big Island of Hawaii. He arrived with the desire to investigate the spiritual world and understand the meaning of life, death, and life after death. And during his career as a board-certified neurosurgeon, curiosity drove him to explore non-traditional healing techniques that broaden the scope of recovery for his patients. Here's Dr. John Turner back on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, good evening, George, and thank you again for allowing me to be here. And thank you, Raymond. Good morning to you. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
Likewise, John. Thank you so much for all your help. This has been so nice.
Oh,
looking forward to this. And, John, by the way, I think I'm going to build a little studio on the Big Island as well, you know, between St. Louis and L.A. I think I'm going to put one in Hawaii in the next 6 months or so.
I think you need to do that, George. This is paradise.
Give us a little broader coverage all over the place. It sure is. Anyway, John, tell me a little bit about your work with Dr. Moody.
Well, you know, I work for Dr. Moody. Let me correct that a bit. Dr. Moody's work had inspired me way back when Life After Life was first published. That and the work of Edgar Cayce were instrumental in my search for this afterlife and what really happens when we die. And I know, George, you've been very interested in this. As I follow your shows, the topic always comes up.
Yeah.
And this, I think, tonight, I think what we're going to discuss is going to give people a lot of hope. And we're going to present the closest thing that I know to proof, which are the shared death experiences that we'll talk about. But in a nutshell, this is what happened. I was doing filming a year or more ago of a documentary called Spirit. And on my website blog, you can see about all these things. But during a break in the filming, Viv Summers, the director and producer, was listening to me talk about my wish to go to Brazil to study John of God and to experience that whole healing phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to meet the great opera star Stephen Salters there just to experience it. And then suddenly Viv said, well, I want to go too. And that led to an expedition plan to go down there as well as a TV project. And over the next year, as we worked hard for this TV project, we were about ready to begin this next year, the Luminary Lecture Series featuring Dr. Raymond Moody as the first speaker came up. These will be held early next year. They'll start. And as a result, I was asked to work for Dr. Moody in trying to promote his great work, because I tell you, George, as you're going to learn tonight as we discuss the brain and these experiences, that the shared death experiences are going to make non-believers believers. So this is what happened over the last year and a half since I last talked to you, George. Amazing things have happened. And now I have the great honor of being with the father of near-death experiences. It's just tremendous.
Raymond, we've talked about this before, but we get a lot of brand new listeners to the program. And, of course, you are at the forefront of near-death experience research. Tell us how you first got involved in this.
Well, George, fortunately, I was the very last person who you would expect would get interested in something like that, which is, I think in terms of any strength that I have as a researcher, it really comes from the fact that I didn't come from a religious family. My dad was a hardened military person from World War II. He had been a medic and a surgeon in the Pacific Theater. And, you know, that generation, as you know, didn't talk about things. So it was a long time before I realized he must have had some really horrific experiences in World War II. So anyway, when he came back home after World War II, he was just very, very, sour on religion. And so, I just didn't grow up a religious person. And, So I got interested in astronomy at about the age of 7, and which is still one of my big passions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had pretty much decided at an early age from my study of science and so on that what happens when you die is that your body just rots and your consciousness goes to zero. And that belief was really, really very deeply implanted in me. And one thing I've noticed both as a psychiatrist and as a human being over the years is that the ideas that you develop as a child are really kind of hard to overcome. In other words, that they sort of stay with you in a very deep way. Well, anyway, in high school, I got interested in philosophy as well, but then at age 18, I went off to the University of Virginia. This was in 1962, and my intention was to go on to get a PhD in philosophy, but in my first few days at UVA, I took a philosophy course my first semester, and in my first few days at UVA, reading Plato's Republic, I decided I was going to be a philosophy major. And Plato is still one of my great heroes of life. And anyway, toward the end of the Republic, there's this story about a warrior, who gets apparently killed and is believed dead on the battlefield. But during the funeral ceremony, he sits up and he sort of revives and to his friend's astonishment starts talking about this voyage he had into another dimension beyond life. Well, I heard some other stories like that from ancient Greek philosophers, and actually the study of near-death experiences was one of the big focal points of early Greek philosophy, which, as you know, really formed the entire Western intellectual tradition. But anyway, in my third year at UVA, one of my philosophy professors told me that right there in Charlottesville at the medical school was Dr. George Ritchie, who was a professor of psychiatry, who some years before had been pronounced dead for an amazing length of time, at least 9 minutes. And during that time had an astonishing experience. And George Ritchie was very open to talking with students. So very soon thereafter, I heard him talk about his experience to a group of students. It just overwhelmed me. Then I went on and in 4 more years got my PhD in philosophy at UVA. And in 1969, started to teaching philosophy at a university, and in that context, heard a lot from my students who had been through this experience, then began to lecture to civic clubs around town, heard these same stories from the prominent business people in town, and then, to make a long story short, since that time, especially once I got to medical school in 72 and started hearing a lot of these stories from patients, have had the very great honor of literally talking with thousands of people from all over the world who've been to the brink of death and got revived and had these astonishing stories of what happened to them afterward.
Let's talk about some of these experiences, Raymond, of near-death experiences. What are some of the top ones on your research list?
Well, basically what we find, and this has actually been confirmed now by physicists, physicians pretty much all over the world, and that is that there's this common pattern, and that is that people will tell us, for example, that at the point where they almost died, where their heart stops beating, that they tell us that they seem to slip out of their body, they rise up, they witness the scene of the resuscitation from a point of view above. They tell us they can actually see their own physical bodies down below being resuscitated. After a while in this, they move through a passageway, which they compare to a tunnel, into a brilliant and beautiful light, they say far brighter than anything we have ever experienced while we're alive, and yet full of complete comfort and peace, joy. People say this light is almost permeated by love, love far greater than any of us have experienced while we're alive. In that light, they talk about seeing relatives or friends of theirs who have passed away, who seem to be there almost in the role of a greeting committee to help them across. And they tell us of panoramic memory, in which they say that in many cases, every single detail of their lives is displayed around them in this instantaneous, three-dimensional, holographic panorama. They say everything you've ever done is reviewed right there in front of you in full color and three dimensions. And during this experience, people say that they typically don't watch the action from the point of view they had when they were doing each action, but rather when the action has its consequence, they are embedded in the consciousness of those with whom they've interacted. And hence, if you see yourself doing a mean-spirited action to somebody in this panorama, then you feel the hurt that you brought about in that person's life. Or if you see yourself doing kind-hearted actions, then you feel the good feelings you brought about.
Right, and they're dramatic. And John, you know, you as a neurosurgeon, how do we know that some of these experiences aren't some kind of glitch in the brain?
Well, by glitch, George, I think, for example, you mean some type of chemical release, perhaps?
Chemical release, something natural that happens at the moment of near death.
Well, let's talk about that. First, the chemical release has been studied a lot. And much of what I learned, I found in a couple of great books by Pim Van Lommel, The Consciousness Beyond Life, and Chris Carter's new book, Science and the Near-Death Experience. Both of these books do guide someone to where to look for this kind of information. But ketamine is one drug that was explored long ago. It was used as an anesthetic, and it produces a dissociation reaction. People kind of dissociate from their bodies. And John Lilly experimented with this quite a bit. And a lot of people will see these visions, certain things, but none of the things are reproducing what Raymond has just discussed, this panoramic life review, for example, the life-changing experience of going through these. So ketamine is one drug that doesn't seem to be some chemical released in the brain. Another one that I think you and I talked about, George, a year and a half ago is DMT.
Yes.
And that, Dr. Strassman feels, is released by the pineal gland. And again, this is a whole other subject about the pineal being the trapdoor to the soul and all that. But when that is taken or given intravenously, it transports the individual almost instantaneously to a parallel universe, an altered state in which they quite often view other beings working on high-tech equipment. It's very strange. But that could account for the bright light experience if indeed the pineal releases this into the cerebrospinal fluid that's right directly adjacent to an area we call the collicular plate. And that's a connection for auditory and visual connections there. So if it was released, Strassman could be right. It could give us that bright light experience, but it certainly doesn't account for everything else.
This connection, is it something that is microscopic, or
No, this connection is this area, this quadrigeminal plate, physically looks like maybe a half a postage stamp size area in the upper brainstem below the pineal that
okay.
has four little humps, and but anyway, we know that that's where these connections are from our experimentation. Now, what else, George and Raymond? There's this lack of oxygen. People have said this is a phenomenon of a dying brain. But in experiments on medical students and high-altitude climbers, when oxygen deprivation is a factor, this produces disorientation and a certain laziness. And this is quite different than the near-death experience, where people are very clear in their thought, in their hearing, in their vision. And some people describe this, is this not correct, Raymond, as the most lucid and clear they've ever been. So when people begin to lose this oxygen in their breathing, they eventually will pass out. they don't have these other experiences, so that doesn't work. The high carbon dioxide is another theory that people bring up, and again, in resuscitation cases where oxygen and carbon dioxide are measured, they found that the carbon dioxide levels are about the same, and the oxygen levels are higher, actually, in many of those who have had the near-death experience. So all of this falls by the wayside. And in a shared death experience, which Dr. Moody will expound upon, these people in attendance do not have any injured brain. They don't have a lack of oxygen or increased carbon dioxide, and yet they're able to share in the same experiences as the one who is passing. And to me, this is the closest proof as we're ever going to have.
Interesting. And Raymond, through all of this, you talk about an alternative geometry in some near-death experiences. What does that mean?
Yes. Well, George, I absolutely have to second there what John has just said. And I think that this adding the findings about the shared death experience to what we already know about near-death experiences really has got to totally shift the landscape of the debate now, because we know very well, and I can absolutely assure you here, that there is a tidal wave now, George, of what we call empathic death experiences or shared death experiences, which are identically the same phenomenon as what we now know as a near-death experience, except it occurs not to somebody who almost dies and returns, but rather to the bystanders standing around. And every single element that we identify as characteristic of a near-death experience is also reported in many cases by bystanders. And this includes, for example, bystanders who tell us that as their loved one in the bed died, they saw the spirit of the deceased person rise up, often in the form of a transparent replica of the mm-hmm. person or of a golden cloud that leaves the body.
And I bet you get a lot of testimony, Raymond, from nurses and doctors who are
yes, and George, that was first the first one of these I heard was from one of my own medical school professors in 72 who described getting out of her own body and going partway toward this light with her mother, who she had unsuccessfully tried to resuscitate. And back in the early 70s through the early 80s and on into the mid 80s, I was hearing these mostly from doctors and nurses. And then what happened is that there's been a total change in the hospital practice recently, or the past. Recently, to somebody at age 66 means, you know, roughly within the last 20 years, but more recently, you know, and what's happened is there's been this major change in hospital practice, whereas when I went to medical school, when the patient was dying, it was the custom for doctors and nurses to come in and sort of escort the patient's family out on the theory that this would be too overwhelming.
Right. They wanted them long gone, didn't they?
Exactly. And then just that began to change. And now, here in 2010, the custom is almost entirely the reverse, that that the doctors and nurses try to make themselves scarce and encourage the families to be there to the very end. Well, I've seen along with this a concomitant shift from, whereas in the early 70s, through the 80s, I was hearing these mostly from doctors and nurses. Now I hear them predominantly from the loved ones who are there at the bedside of their dying family members.
Raymond, we're going to take this quick break, but we'll come back and talk more about this with Dr. Raymond Moody and Dr. John Turner. The latest work, Glimpses of Eternity, by Dr. Raymond Moody with Paul Perry. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Dr. Raymond Moody and Dr. John Turner. Raymond, we were talking about how the death experience is being shared now by a loved one, by a doctor, by a nurse, that they just seem to be able to share this. How does this happen?
Well, George, if you've got the answer to that one, let me know right away.
Really?
But I tell you, this is something, George, that's going to really totally change the debate, because it's in this kind of society, it's superficially plausible to say about the near-death experiences when somebody almost dies and their oxygen gets cut off to the brain and so on. There's a surface plausibility in saying that the experience was caused by the diminished oxygen flow creating a hallucination or whatever. But if the same phenomenon is reported in every detail, George, by the people standing around whose impression is or feeling is that they partially accompany their dying loved one to the other side. For example, I have many cases of people saying that when a loved one died in the bed, that the bystanders themselves feel like they get out of their body, they go part way toward this light with the dying loved one. People will tell me that as their loved one dies, the room fills up with this extraordinary light that permeates everything. As you mentioned earlier, a common thing I hear is that people say in some indescribable way that the whole geometry of the room changed, rather than finding themselves in the cubicle shape or the rectangular solid shape of a hospital room. The room seemed to distort in its shape and often seems to form up into a sort of hourglass shape. People will say that they hear heavenly music that seems to be coming from nowhere. I hear lots of cases in which people say that as their loved one dies, they perceive the spirits of the deceased relatives and friends of the person who's dying seem to come to meet the person who's just died. And most incredibly of all to me, George, this is one that just really is astonishing, but I have a number of cases in which some person standing by empathically co-lives the panoramic life review of the person who's dead.
That's phenomenal.
Now, what is going on here? You've known me for a long time, and you've known that I'm just very reluctant to draw the conclusion that there's an afterlife, since it was not in my background. It's a very difficult thing for me to put together for myself, and yet...
Well, that's what makes you so credible.
But now, you know, I've really gotten into the point where I'm sort of feeling boxed into a corner in the sense that...
You're tipping, aren't you?
In the sense, George, that now, I mean, I try to pay close attention to what's going on inside of me, and now it's beginning to seem that when I try to put some other thing other than just what seems to be, namely that there does seem to be a state of existence after death, I feel inside like I'm running away from something or trying to rationalize rather than just to face what seems to be. So it really has tipped me over, along with some other stuff. I mean, there's a big background on this, but... basically, I think it's going to be very hard now to argue this case against this being connected somehow with an afterlife, because one of the signs of a weak argument, as you know, is from your interviewing experience, and which I know as a professor of logic and critical thinking, you know, when somebody has a weak case, one sign of it is they shift their grounds on you. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take the position of a hypothetical scoffer, let's say, who looks at all this, and when they're confronted with the stories of the near-death experience, somebody who almost dies and returns, they say, oh, well, obviously that's the cutoff of the oxygen flow to the brain. But then you say, well, what about the bystanders who have the same experience, and yet they're not ill or injured, there's nothing wrong with their brain?
Good point.
Then they shift to a psychological explanation, and they say, oh, they're just hysterical or emotional or wishful thinking or whatever. Well, that's not fair. That's a sign that somebody's case is weak. You see, like to shift grounds like that. So it's got to be, you know, it's like to, it's not fair to make that kind of move. And so it's really pushing me toward saying, in effect, well, if it's not life after death, what is this? I mean, this is something really, really important that we need to take a look at.
And maybe we go back, Raymond, to where we began, you know, in this hall of souls just waiting to be born, and then here we are, and it goes back again. I don't know.
Well, you know, that's certainly what Plato said in this, in many of his works, but he talks about that in The Republic, this warrior who was believed dead on the battlefield but revived, talks about that very thing, about seeing people sort of lined up to be born. And this is a really exciting development, I think, because one thing, you know, George, how conservative I am in inferences, but one thing I feel completely confident in saying is that in another 5 years' time, the whole debate about life after death, and I'm talking here about the rational debate, is going to look an entirely different way. I mean, there's things coming here that are just going to be very, very difficult to talk your way out of. It's beginning to look like to me within the next few years we're going to have, and I mean genuine, solid progress toward rational comprehension of this mystery of an afterlife.
All right. Now, let's bring in Dr. John Turner. John, let's react to some of this based on the things you've heard Raymond talk about.
Well, first of all, I have some interesting comments on that. This altered geometry. You know, George, a year and a half ago when we talked, it was March 24th, and my small book had just come out, and I've learned so much since the publication of that book, George. The main thing I've learned is forgiveness, true forgiveness. But I've learned a lot of technical things. And I can say now that, you know, I used to think the brain produced consciousness. And all through my training, medical school, and then neurosurgery, and then in the years of practice, I would have always answered that question that way. The brain produces all that we know. But now I've changed, George. I've learned through many people who have studied this all their lives and all the study I've done that consciousness produces the brain. So I think we have to look at the brain as much as we look at a radio receiver. And the fact that a radio produces the music doesn't mean that it generates the music. It simply interprets it. So since everything that we look at or we see now, George, as we look around, and Raymond, we're looking at our room here and whatever, is all a manifestation of energy. You'd have to agree with that. And the brain kind of keeps this in the form that it needs to be. It acts as a governor so we can go through these experiences we're here to do. But we're all in a field of consciousness. This whole thing is consciousness. And then it gets complicated with the parallel universes and all that. But I think this wavering of geometry has to do with the brain, you know, losing some of that filtering effect to allow those things to happen. I think this bird's eye view when people leave their body has to do a lot with the fact that this is the way sometimes we see things in memory. We see it as a bird's eye view or a first-person view. But being in the corner of the room, my friend John Lerma once asked me, he said, Doctor, I think maybe the corner of the room has kind of a tetrahedron shape, and that power shape, you know, dates back to the pyramids of Egypt and all those things. He's thinking, well, maybe that's why people find themselves in the corner of the room ready to go into this next dimension. So that's how I kind of react to the things Raymond has said. I think the shared experiences, though, to me, cannot be explained away by any activity of the brain other than perhaps the mirror neurons that Dr. Moody mentions in this book. This may allow someone who is really close to that patient, and as I recall, Raymond, it's the ones who are closest to the patient are the ones who really are able to experience this life review. But the fact that others, George and Raymond, who are not close to the patient, you know, emotionally, like doctors.
Like
a
doctor or nurse, sure.
Yeah, they state that they see some of these things. So you can't write this off as just some connection with the patient. We've got to look at this to say, look, this obviously is another dimension. And Raymond describes in his great book these portals that open up into this light. And some of the respondents have said they've actually left their body with the person who's passing and have been told, no, this is not your time, and they can't go on. Just like the near-death experiencers who reach some type of a barrier, something that prevents them from going. And it's true, they're often given a choice, but usually there's some type of barrier. And maybe Raymond can elucidate this more.
Well, yes, and you know, in connection with that, there's yet another kind of case that goes along with the shared death experience that raises some issues, I think, with the mirror neuron hypothesis, John, and that is that I hear lots of cases, too, of people who tell me that they were across town and or in another state. And suddenly, they knew that their grandfather, for example, had just passed away, and later on received the news. I remember in the early 80s in Charlottesville, I took my kids to a basketball game, and the seat next to us was an acquaintance of ours who just happened to be in the next seat, and we started talking to our acquaintance. And she had this young man with her who was a relative of hers who was in his early 20s. And our acquaintance introduced him to me and mentioning the work I'd done with near-death experiences. And then he brightened up and he told me this story about how several years earlier when he was 18 years old, just in the middle of the day, like suddenly, he began to feel this out-of-body experience going up through a passageway into a light and was totally baffled about this. And then shortly thereafter, he found that his identical twin, who was obviously 18 also at that time, had several states away died at that very time. And there was no... this identical twin was not in any way ill, or well, this was just something that came out of the blue. So sometimes we can have these things that in which the spatial relationship or the spatial proximity doesn't seem to matter either.
What causes, Raymond, this connection?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. You know, George, that is a real mystery. What is this? I mean, one thing that all of this causes me to realize is that these near-death experiences and shared death experiences are not necessarily related to the time-space framework that we exist in. And so then what do you say? What do you say? Well, I think the... two things I think are going to happen with the whole study of the afterlife, and I think this is going to be very quickly now. First of all, I think these shared death experiences like that Paul Perry and I describe in our new book, Glimpses of Eternity, that these shared death experiences now have to be taken into account in the same sort of way that we finally started taking into account near-death experiences. I mean, this is to a point now, George, where it carries its own verification.
Mm-hmm.
My philosophy in publishing a book is that I never publish anything until I'm absolutely sure that anybody who sincerely looks into it, in other words, any sincere investigator who conducts their own research and looks around is going to be able to confirm it for themselves. Literally anybody who wants to know about this. especially somebody in the medical field, of course, or psychological field, but also just any ordinary person will be able, just by asking around in a sympathetic way among your own loved ones and friends, and will be able to find cases of these shared death experiences. Well, so we've got to own up to this in some way. So I think that's one thing, that the rise of these shared death experiences, which are existing now, I think, in enough numbers that anybody's going to be able to find plenty of cases of this. That is one thing. That's got to shift the framework of the debate, because we can't run away from that by saying, well, let's, brain damage caused by the oxygen flow being cut off. And then another thing that I think is going to happen is that I think that very soon now it's going to come out that there will be entirely new rational means of investigating the question of an afterlife. And I think specifically, George, what this is going to be is that, although this is probably a topic for another time, but basically just to sketch it out for you, I think I can assure you that there are ways to prepare people by opening up aspects of the mind that haven't been fully explored or that exist but are now sort of inhibited, and that by opening these up in people, this will prepare people who subsequently, just by chance, have a near-death experience to come back and articulate it in entirely new ways that get around this problem of ineffability. You know, one of the most common things people with a near-death experience say is that no matter how articulate they may be, that they just have no words, that they find it impossible to describe the experience in ordinary words. Well, this is going to be greatly alleviated now by new developments that are going on in other areas of research. But basically, I think...
Did technology help that, Raymond?
I'm sorry?
Did technology move it along?
No, it's not exactly technology. I think that there are new forms of logic now that, and of course this is now just confined to a very small circle of maybe several hundred scholars and so on, but this is going to be emerging entirely new ways of logic that are going to, not connected with the afterlife necessarily. It's just, this is moving out now into the business community and into the sciences, and these new canons of logic or new systems of logic will greatly help investigating the question of life after death.
But, we are at the top of the hour with Dr. Raymond Moody and John Turner. Dr. Moody's work, Glimpses of Eternity, and we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. John, can you tell us about the term Lazarus syndrome? What does that mean?
Well, George, I was first asked that on Isis Paranormal show, and I had to think carefully about that because I had never seen a case. But actually, there are three things of interest, and it ties in with Dr. Moody's work and what we're talking about. There's a Lazarus effect, a Lazarus sign, and a Lazarus syndrome. And briefly, that story of Lazarus in the Bible is that he was called by the sisters of Lazarus, Martha and Mary, to come and help because he had died. And Jesus didn't come right away. For some reason, he waited and appeared on the fourth day. And that small phrase from the Bible, Jesus wept, had to do with what happened before he resurrected Lazarus. And that's a whole other point. But the point is, he was able to resurrect Lazarus. And that word Lazarus can be interpreted from the Hebrew meaning God has helped. So the Lazarus effect actually is something in physics, and semiconductors and detectors that were placed in, you know, areas of high radiation. What would happen, these high-energy particles would trap the electrons and the holes electron and holes of semiconductor physics, and these detectors would suddenly put out a reduced signal, and they called them, they would become a dead detector. And then what happened back in 1997, it was, in Bern, Switzerland, two investigators found out that at low temperatures, we're talking about, you know, minus 100 something degrees Celsius, these detectors came back to life. And this phenomena they called the Lazarus effect. Well, the Lazarus sign, now they're moving to the medical field, is something that happens in a brain-dead patient. And as I said, I've never seen it, but in people who maybe are doing transplant surgery, once a patient is declared brain dead, and during the time before harvesting the organs, sometimes a reflex, similar to a knee jerk, will happen, and the arms will raise, bend at the elbows, into the air, and then fold across the chest, similar to the Egyptian mummies.
Huh.
And the reason this is important, George, is because, you know, people, nurses and doctors who see this might say, wait a minute, did we make a mistake here? And this reflex is shown to be preceded by a shivering motion of the patient's arms and the appearance of goose flesh on the arms and trunk. And then the arms will flex at the elbows, lift into the air, and then fold above the chest. And I said, it must be a rare thing.
Oh,
I certainly have never seen it. The final thing is the Lazarus syndrome. Now, this is a little more pertinent to what we're discussing today. It's been a handful of cases, maybe 20 or 30, of people who were pronounced dead and then later came to life. There are many such small cases, but the biggest case is one that your guest, Dr. Morse, discussed briefly a few nights ago. He calls the man Yuri, but it's George Radania. And the reason this is important, this is a Russian fellow who was a neuropathologist, and he died, and he was pronounced dead, put it like that, and he was in the morgue. And on the fourth day on the autopsy table, as the knife plunged into his skin, he woke up, so to speak. And this changed him so much that he became a minister. He has passed on, but his near-death experience is pertinent because he describes himself as being in a total realm of darkness, complete blackness. And he came to think, well, what is happening? What had happened? And then he began to see the light, a bright light, at first like a camera flash, but constant brightness. And pretty soon he saw the visions of, what's he described it, molecules and atoms flying about. And then he went through that life review process that Raymond has described so well. He saw his life from beginning to end, all at once, all the drama like a holographic image. And during this encounter with the light, he says what all of these people say, a sense of peace and joy. And the critical thing he realized, he said, and I want to quote him on this, George, he said, I came to see that reality is everywhere, that is not simply the earthly life, but infinite life. Everything is not only connected together, everything is also one. And I think that Raymond's work is really going to show us that we're more than just brothers and sisters, George. We're all one.
No doubt about that. Okay. And Raymond, since you wrote Life After Death, Life After Life years ago, and now this, Glimpses of Eternity, have you seen a change in public's perception of near-death experiences?
Absolutely. You know, when I first started investigating this, which was, I heard George Ritchie in 65, then in 69 I heard it from one of my own students at East Carolina University, and in the 3 years I taught philosophy there, quite a number of students and also businessmen from the community that invited me to their civic clubs and so on. And at that time, what I would hear from people was, you know, they were very reluctant to talk about this because although they knew something extraordinary had happened to them and that it had changed their lives, they were very reluctant to talk about it because they felt that probably they were the only person to whom it had ever happened. And it was a real unknown when I first started investigating it. But then after the publication of Life After Life in 75, and then, as you know, physicians all over the world confirming this in their own societies. I think what's happened now is that there is this very solid public awareness of this phenomenon, but as you know, the standard format of debate is between those who tend to say, oh, this is an afterlife, and then on the other hand, those who explain it away as physiological or neurophysiological. But now, as just John was saying, and I say too, that now with the emergence of identically the same phenomenon, every marker that we use to identify as a near-death experience also occurs in shared death experiences, so there's no real way of differentiating between these two. So now I think that in very short order, the world is going to become aware that somehow this thing that we already know all over the world as the near-death experience seeps out to people standing around. And this has got to make a sort of leap upward of the debate about this. I mean, what is this?
What is causing the evolution, the mood shift, for example?
Well, you know, I think there's probably a lot of things. One is that back in the 70s when I first started hearing them, and on into the 80s, these shared death experiences were mostly something you heard from medical personnel.
Right.
But now with the change of the hospital practice, the families are there till the end, and so just people outside of the medical community are commonly experiencing this. And then I think one thing, and this is just entirely Raymond Moody speaking here, I'm not a sociologist, but I do really feel, George, that don't you think a lot more people now are becoming aware that the world is in deep trouble?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I was at a conference in San Leandro, California, Raymond and John, this weekend, this Saturday, and my very first question to this packed audience in the Bowel Theater was, how many of you feel, show your hands, how many of you feel as if government is going in the right direction?
Yeah.
Not one hand went up. Not one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're absolutely
right. And then, you know, with all of the many very complex factors coming together, I think that this is, you know, people are reaching out for something. This naturally turns people's thought to mortality. And it's very common when people get in their 50s and 60s, they begin to think of mortality. And then you think of the vast number of baby boomers, that post-World War II generation, that are now getting into that period where mortality is just a natural development as people start thinking about this. That I think this is going to turn people's attention to this whole question of life after death now in a very, very serious way.
In Glimpses of Eternity, did people see the ectoplasm, the mist leaving the body?
Yes, this is something I've heard from a long time from doctors and nurses, as I said, initially back in the 70s, but now from lots and lots of family members and so on, or friends who they're at the bedside of dying loved ones will tell us that as their loved one dies, they seem to see something stand up or sort of rise up from the dead body. And this may be described as a transparent replica almost of the person, or in many cases, this mist, for want of a better term. People say, again, it's very difficult to describe this, but they say it's not just like a cloud of like a cloud you would see in the sky, because it has what seems to be an active inner structure to it, but that insofar as they can describe it, they describe a golden or golden grayish mist which seems at the point of death to rise from the body. Not so long ago, I heard an Italian physician describe it to me as he said he saw this golden light just form up around the chest, as I believe he said, of his patient who had just died, and then to rise up, and it seemed to just disappear through the ceiling. And again, you know, if you ask around among physicians, you're going to hear lots of cases of this. And what is that? I mean, one difficulty is that we really don't have the conceptual apparatus to talk about this. And you know what, George? One of the great tragedies, really, of the whole area of interest that you and I and John and many other people have is that, unfortunately, the opposition, who calls themselves the skeptics, are so utterly incoherent in their approaches that they don't even know what the word skeptic means. And this to me is particularly irritating because, as you may know, one of my favorite things to do is to teach ancient Greek philosophy. And when I get to the real skeptics and explain to students what that means, it came from the ancient Greek philosopher Pyrrho, Pyrrho, who was post-Aristotelian, and is a very legitimate philosophical movement, and yet these contemporary people who don't even know what the word means say, "Oh, I'm a skeptic about these near-death experiences. I think it's just the chemistry of the brain or whatever." Well, you know, to be a genuine skeptic, they need to stick to what they know about, which is certainly not anything about skepticism. Right. But what we got to have now is a real formulation of some sort of new rational means of getting at this problem, because the old framework of debate is not going to work anymore.
But people seem willing to listen this time, though, Raymond, don't they?
They do. There's so many things coming around now that are just so complex. We're in such a complex condition of existence now that people are beginning to come out of the doldrums. I think partly maybe because of all the baby boomers now facing their mortality or so on. But we are in for a real shakeup in the way that the question of life after death is debated, and it's going to come. And you know how conservative I am, but I'm completely confident within the next 5 years, we're going to see a whole different way to look at this question and debate about it.
And John, I want you to know, by the way, you're featured quite prominently in the book, Tell Me What You See. It is Ed Dames and Joel Harry Newman's book. And
I was looking at that book, George, and, you know, the remote viewing and all these things have to do with, you know, how does this consciousness work? And, you know, as Raymond said, I didn't mean to interrupt you, George, but as Raymond said, you know, we can no longer doubt this. We've talked about the oxygen effects, and they don't really reproduce this near-death experience to deprive the brain of oxygen. We've talked about carbon dioxide, and a high carbon dioxide level does not do it. The other things that have been studied, the chemicals we talked about, they don't really, they mimic some of these things, but certainly not the key features like the life review. We didn't talk about the gravity-induced problems. You know, the famous paper of Dr. Winery, it was in the Journal of Near-Death Studies in 1997 with the fighter pilots and the centrifuge. Well, it produced some of these effects, and the skeptics that Raymond alluded to might say, well, this is what happens. The brain is deprived of blood flow. But, you know, there were no life reviews in those cases. 70% had convulsions, which we don't see in these near-death experiences, and no changes in personality values. And the other thing, they did see relatives, but no deceased relatives were seen in these little dreamlets. And then we have the cases of, like, Pam Reynolds and Dr. Morris's cases of a child underwater. So Raymond is right. Something is going to explode, and that explosion is going to be to realize that it's not like shutting off a light switch when we leave here. There's something else that continues, and we just may have to realize that if we're not learning our lessons, we may have to repeat them.
Well, you might have to. Raymond, you talk a little bit, too, about the music and sound, the near-death experiences. What causes that?
Well, again, you know, I don't know, but I do know this, that George Ritchie, who was the finest person I ever knew, George, he was, I met him in 65 when I was an undergraduate at UVA. He died about 3 years ago. Still the finest human being I ever knew. George said that during his near-death experience, he heard music so beautiful, he said that there was simply no way to describe it.
The trumpets, right?
Well, I don't know of anybody who's specifically told me of trumpets, but they say that this is just absolutely heavenly music. I hear this also from people with shared death experience who say that they hear this music suddenly going on as their loved ones are dying, like a celestial music or something coming from nowhere. And George, another really interesting thing, this is again, something that anybody with patience and sincere attitude of investigation can find out for themselves, although it's not recorded anywhere in the literature that I know of, except in a couple of places where I wrote about it, and also in Plato's Phaedo. But that is that... not nearly as common as the near-death experience, but nonetheless common enough that any diligent, sincere investigator is going to be able to find cases. And that is that sometimes in the last few hours or days or sometimes minutes of somebody's life, that even if, according to their relatives, as far as their relatives knew, they never had any interest whatsoever in poetry or song, that they will start reciting poetry or sometimes singing, sometimes even making up poetry on the spot. And this phenomenon was recorded by Plato in his dialogue, The Phaedo. It happened to Socrates on Socrates' last day of life.
I wonder, Raymond, if that's where they also got the songs from angels and things like that, from these near-death experiences. Stay with us. We're at the half, but we'll be back with more. Raymond, generally, what has happened to people who are part of this near-death experience, the sharing portion, does that change them? Is this a life-altering event for them?
It really does. It does. And it gives them a lot to think about. I've heard a lot of people over the years have told me that whereas before they were dubious about an afterlife or felt there wasn't an afterlife, or really, as most people do, apparently, just sort of go through life without really thinking much about it, that this really does convince them that there's something afterward. I hear a lot of people, you know, when they're telling the stories or have a look on their face of just utter astonishment. They, you know, they can't deny what they saw and felt. And yet it came as a real surprise to them.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so it does that. Now, one thing is I haven't seen the same kind of thing that you do with people, for example, who come back from a near-death experience and see this panorama unfold and come back and tell us that the most important thing we can do with our lives is to learn how to love. And instead, it wakes them up to the reality of an afterlife, but they don't come back with the same message of love. And I suspect that probably has to do with the fact that the great majority of them don't go through this panoramic life review. In other words, that seems to be the factor in the near-death experience that wakes people up to the to this universal love. Now, at the same time, I will say that I've heard plenty of cases where people empathically co-live this dying review or life review with their dying loved one, and that does ring about this sense of love. One of the most fascinating cases I had, George, was this wonderful lady I first knew in Carrollton, Georgia, where I used to teach psychology 20-plus years ago, and she had one of these marriages with her husband where they had literally grown up together in the same little town as neighbors, and then as they grew older, just sort of naturally developed into a marriage relationship, and after they decided to get married in high school, shortly thereafter, she got pregnant. And believe me, in small-town Georgia back in her era,
that's
an utterly, a real scandal. And so they were in the process of trying to figure out how they were going to tell their parents about this. No thought at that time of, you know, having an abortion or anything like that. It was a different era. And so, but in the midst of all this, they were trying to decide how to bring this up to their parents. She lost the baby in a spontaneous miscarriage. And then throughout the rest of their marriage together, they didn't have any children. She was unable to get pregnant anymore. Well, her husband developed a really fast-acting lung cancer after several decades of marriage, and she was there with him at his deathbed, and as he passed away, she said this panorama consisting of their entire life. It was focused on his life, but she saw in it the scenes in which she was participating as well. And she said, out of the segment or aspect of this life review that had to do with their loss of their baby, she said all through their marriage, they had always talked about this child as though it had been a boy. Although, you know, there was no identification made. It was just, you know, but they assumed it was a boy. But she said in this review, in which she was actually communicating with her husband, he was obviously seeing and talking about the same scenes that she was witnessing. She said out of that aspect of it emerged this little form or a form of and this form came up and identified herself to them as not their son, but their daughter. And so as you can imagine, this was a very touching and overwhelming experience for this woman. And she said that they reviewed his life and the presence of this being of complete love and compassion. This obviously changed her outlook in this very dramatic way. She came out of this telling me that she learned from this review, not of her life, but her husband's life, that really what counts more than anything else is the quality of love that you have in your life. And this is identically what we hear from people with near-death experiences.
Do you have to have any religious background, or do you have to be spiritual, Raymond?
Absolutely not. I've had this both in the case of these shared death experiences and also of the near-death experiences. I've had plenty of people who have these kinds of experiences who say that prior to this they had no religious interest or background whatsoever, and yet they have very dramatic experiences. It really doesn't have anything to do, I think, with religion.
Jeez. All right, John, let's bring you back in here. and get your reaction to all of this overall from your perspective as a neurosurgeon. And I do want to ask you a personal question because I have a friend. Yeah. I might as well do that, get it out of the way.
Right.
He fell a year ago. He's got cord syndrome, and he hasn't severed anything, but he's still paralyzed from the neck down. What's wrong with him?
Well, I can tell you this much, George. When I was in medical school, I worked on a research project in the animal lab. And what I would do is expose the spinal cord of dogs in the thoracic area. And then we would drop a small weight through a tube onto the spinal cord. It would just hit the spinal cord and bounce, but the dog would be completely paralyzed. And then we would examine the spinal cord later, looking for some way to prevent this damage. So it doesn't have to take a break in the spinal cord to paralyze someone. Now, the good news perhaps for your friend is that he may recover in the neck. The spinal cord in that area has a good blood supply. In the thoracic area, it's completely different. But I would say if your friend was recently paralyzed, there's a good chance that a lot of recovery is going to come his way.
It's been about a year, though.
Well, you know, and he has no signs of any recovery?
Well, he's moving his arms and legs, but, I mean, he's not doing it to the point where he can get up and, you know, and take care of himself or feed himself. He's kind of like shuffling. I bought him an iPad so he can email now by, you know, like kind of moving his fingers over the screen.
I understand.
But,
well,
man, it's been a year. It's frustrating.
There are a lot of things that are on the horizon, like stem cell injections, so forth. And there are a lot of complementary medical treatments that can occur. I received a email early today from an engineer in Ohio who said that if you can, please get some information to Mr. Norrie that there are some treatments for disease that perhaps he should be aware of. So at a later date, I'll share that with you, George. It may be pertinent.
All right. And that, of course, leads us into some of the work that you've been doing with Dr. Moody about all of this. These are shared experiences. Are you amazed at how often these experiences are shared, John?
Well, yes, let me tell you, George, I didn't really know much about the shared experience of the last few years. And a couple of years ago when my mother passed, I was sitting at her bedside. For the last 3 weeks, George, she went into a complete sleeping thing. She didn't wake up. She couldn't take any fluid. She was in the last stages of Alzheimer's disease at age 99 almost. And as I sat with her the night she did make her transition, she suddenly woke up and turned and looked right in my eyes. And as Raymond knows, I took that chance to look right in her eyes and say, Mom, I want to tell you again that thanks to you and everything you've done, we're all going to be just fine, and you can go now. Well, she closed her eyes and went back to sleep. And had I known about the shared death experiences, I would not have left the room. What I did, I set the clock for 2 hours because I would turn her every 2 hours. She was completely bedridden. And I ran to the next room, and I tried to sleep. And as I went to sleep, I had a dream, George. And in the dream, I was making rounds in a hospital. I was wearing a white coat, making rounds, and a nurse said, Dr. Turner, please look at your mother. And I walked over to the bed where she was, and I pulled out my pen and I wrote on the bedspread, no oral intake for 3 weeks. Family does not wish to push fluid, just like an order to the nurses. And as soon as I signed my name, I woke up. I went into the next room and sure enough, she wasn't breathing. Had I stayed, I might have experienced this. And I think this is appropriate segue to Dr. Moody, if he doesn't mind, telling of his shared experience.
Well, yes, George, I have been into this for many, many years. The first one I heard was from one of my own medical school professors in 1972, right at the end of my first quarter of medical school, who had resuscitated her own mother and had an empathic or shared death experience when her mother passed away. And so I've been working on this for a long time, and in 1994, I was getting ready to do a systematic study of these shared death experiences. And to make a long story short, I was out west with a bunch of other doctors and so on, and we were talking this over. We had a meeting, and on Sunday, when we finished our meeting, it happened to be Mother's Day. And it was in May of 94. So I went to the local shopping mall and used an antique object that we used to call a payphone, which hardly exists anymore. But I went to a payphone at the shopping mall, and I called Mom to wish her a happy Mother's Day. And, of course, as you would, I just said, well, how are you doing? And I remember, George, how absolutely chipper her voice was, just very cheerful.
Yeah.
She said, oh, I'm doing great. And then she went on to say, and she said, and yesterday I developed this rash. And she said that my brothers and sisters had gotten concerned, so they took her down to the emergency room, and a doctor looked her over and really just kind of dismissed it. He said he didn't think this was anything significant, just some sort of idiosyncratic response. But as a precaution, he gave her an appointment to see another doctor on Monday, which would have been the day after I talked with her. So anyway, on Sunday when I talked with her, everything was doing fine. The next day she went to the doctor, and the doctor examined her, and he said, you have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. You have 2 days to 2 weeks to live. And so my wife and I went to there, and we were with her in the hospital the entire 2 weeks. She did indeed die 2 weeks after the diagnosis. And so, George, I mean, again, words fail me here, but basically what happened was that my mother was comatose for 2 days, but just in the process of dying, as she was dying, she sort of came to, she said twice very audibly, I love you. And as she was dying, for want of a better term, George, people who've been through this know there are really no words, but the best way I can describe it to you is to say that rather instead of like in a three-dimensional space, we were in this curved space. It was like I felt that the room was kind of hourglass shaped and was filled with this light. And I have never had such an experience before or after in my life. Everything was completely calm. A complete peace came over the situation. My wife, who was there with me, had the same experience. My sister felt the presence or experienced the presence of my father, who had passed away about 18 months before. My brother-in-law had the same kind of very, very thrilling and uplifting experience. You know, one thing is, again, I can pretty much say that, you know, I'm driven by curiosity, as you are. Mm-hmm. And what happened at that point was that my curiosity, by and large, was satisfied. In other words, I'd been working on these empathic death experiences for a long time, but being driven by curiosity. But when it happened to me, it put a whole new light on it, and it took me that really pretty much stopped my plans to do a book on it right then, because I felt, well, it's happened to me, and it put my curiosity on a different track. But in the intervening 16 years, what I've done is that I've continued to accumulate more cases, and it's reached the point now where anybody really who looks into this in a sincere way is going to be able to find plenty of cases. So I figured it was time to bring out Glimpses of Eternity now. And I'm sure that what will happen when this comes out is that, again, anybody who wants to find cases of this for themselves are going to be able to do so quite readily.
John, what about out-of-body experiences? How prevalent are they?
Ago, I was describing the experience I had, and You know, I had listened to you speak with Mary Ellen Guiley about the fact that life as we know it could be just a dream. And I completely agree with that. I think that we'll wake up one day in that new dream and things will continue on. But you asked Mary Ellen this question. You said, can one go from a lucid or a dreaming state into the out-of-the-body state? And she said, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I recounted to you my experience of having that, which involved this complete blackness, that, you know, without any feeling of dread, but a complete blackness at the start. And you've interviewed our friend Robert Bruce before, and, of course, you know, this out-of-the-body experiences are quite common. And I think that it's interesting in Dr. Moody's work, dating back to his first book, he explains that some people do experience a buzzing or a clicking or some type of a sound thing, and then they enter a tunnel before they are actually out of their body. And this has been described, well, through the ages in all types of literature about out of the body, sensing that clicking, that buzzing, or something that, that precedes the out of the body experience. So I think now that people are more willing to talk about these things, we're going to hear more and more about this, George.
Absolutely. We've got various websites for you. Take heed, Dr. John Turner's, johnlturner.com, Raymond Moody's, lifeafterlife.com as well. They're already linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. What we'll do when we come back at the top of the hour, we will take your phone calls with both of them. I know many of you have stories that you want to share, perhaps about those shared deathbed experiences as well. If you need to ever email me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com. I'm expecting a lot of emails from the folks who went out to San Leandro, California for the UFO X Fest. So that's what you use, George at coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Raymond, of all the stories you investigated for Glimpses of Eternity, is there that one that just stands out for you? Hello, Raymond?
Raymond must be taking a break, but maybe I can help with that question, George.
Yep, go ahead.
I think the one that stands out for Raymond is going to be the experience he had, you know, shared at the time his mother passed. But he recounts so many great stories in his books, as you know, George, that it probably he couldn't pick one as a favorite any more than we can say one of our children is a favorite. So I would say there's just so many. I think some of the stories he tells have been kind of favorites with me, though, George. I think I could comment on that. And he talks about a 9-year-old boy that had this experience of the near death when he was suddenly found himself in the hospital and the mask of ether was placed on his face. And I believe, George, you had a near-death experience at age 9, did you not?
I sure did. At 11 o'clock, actually, I had an OBE.
Well, maybe we could hear about that because that's got to be a favorite for you, right?
Yeah, sure is. Let's go. We'll take a few phone calls here while we have you. Let's go to Ed in Phoenix, Arizona. Ed, welcome to the program. You are on Coast to Coast with us. Hello, Ed. Take it away.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm from when I was a kid at 10 years old up in Bel Air, Michigan. I took and lived on a farm, and I loved the smell of gasoline, and I took and was supposed to be filling the tractor with gas, but I was smelling the gas through the top of the gas can and passed out. I did this 3 times. The third time I passed out, I found myself going down this tunnel faster and faster, going towards a very bright light at the end. But something I've never heard anybody before say, never, is that both sides of the tunnel were lined with creatures. They were black creatures who were reaching out for me and screeching as I went by. And I've never heard anybody ever say, describe anything like that before.
Well, Ed, if I may comment on that while we're waiting for Dr. Moody.
Yeah, I think he's here. Raymond's here with us, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I heard you, George, and I replied, but apparently something was gone wrong with my phone or something. Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear.
Oh, good. Okay.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Okay, I was going to say that these tunnels seem to be a little bit culture-specific, and I hope Raymond will agree. Within my research, the Western view of the experience does describe the tunnel, and this may have to do with the architecture that we're exposed to, because in other cultures, they often talk about a darkness or a cave or something like that. But, You know, this tunnel that you're describing, Ed, I think I've read that before. Have you not, Raymond, that there's things along the passage that sometimes may not be that agreeable as someone reaches that light?
Yes, I have. And this brings up the question of negative experiences, which Ed is describing here. And of course, can be quite disturbing when they occur. One thing is that and I don't know what to say about your experience, Ed, except that I'm certainly glad that you got through it. But I have definitely heard a few of these, but they seem to be quite rare compared to the other types. And then the most systematic studies that have been done of the negative experiences, they're quite rare compared to the positive ones, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't pay attention to them.
Well, I was 10 years old living in the country back in 1950. In those days, we'd never heard nothing about the tunnels, this, that. This was a first time I'd ever heard anything about it, first time I ever experienced it. And it was out of the blue. I came to with my uncle pouring coffee down my throat. And I lived with my father, my aunt and uncle. And my aunt slapped me in the face. Thank goodness they found me laying in the snow unconscious, or I wouldn't be here today.
Well, I'm glad you made it back.
Thank you very much. You have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Raymond and John, is there any hard data out there that would back up all these? Because, you know, we have a belief system, there's no doubt. But does science ever come up with the hard data to say, hey, we know this exists? I guess they can't, can they?
Well, George, you mean hard data that there is such a thing as out of the body or a near-death experience?
Yes.
Well, you know, back in the 50s when the great neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield at the Montreal Neurologic Institute began to stimulate the temporal lobe areas and also the areas between the main part of the brain, the frontal lobes, and the temporal lobe called the Sylvian fissure, he found out some interesting things, that a dual stream of consciousness seems to occur. In other words, the patients awake for the stimulation could say, oh, I have the memory of my great aunt singing the song or something like that, where they still knew that they were in the operating room and Dr. Penfield was operating on them. What he found out was very interesting, George, that the neuron stimulated actually didn't respond to the electrical pulses. It was the surrounding neurons, and it was a connection all through the brain and spinal cord that seemed to respond. So he concluded saying that he could not locate where is consciousness in the brain and so forth. Now, things have progressed. Now we have functional MRIs and PET machines which can tell what areas of the brain are active. And the most interesting thing we found, and Dr. Lerma is doing some experiments on this, and others have too, because Dr. Morris has a project with this, is to say, well, what happens to the patient as they're dying during the sudden period of lucidity, when these brain areas are firing off that we thought were damaged and were not going to be repaired? We're seeing this happen now. So science is trying to silently tell us everything, and we're learning more and more each day. And it's hard to refute the evidence that's out there now. And I think the projects that I hope we can discuss before the end of the hour that Dr. Moody is involved in, and I'm involved in a few, to show to the general person that, look, there is something to look forward to and to have hope for. And as I mentioned earlier, it's not just simply we're here and that's it. There's more to come, and it may go on forever and ever.
Does this skew sex at all? Men, women, are they more likely to have had this shared deathbed experience?
I think Raymond will agree that, no, there doesn't seem to be any proclivity for the sex, right? It's something that religion doesn't seem to play a great part in. And I will turn that over to Raymond to discuss that further.
Well, yes, I think that by and large, as we all know, women, as opposed to men, are a little more likely to be able to talk about something like this because of our society. Men are more reluctant often to share their emotions. But I think in terms of the incidence of this, it makes no difference. Male or female have these things at about the same rate. But George, I would like to go back to for a moment to the question you raised about whether there is hard scientific evidence on this, and to first of all agree entirely with what John said, and also to go on to say that one thing that we often don't think about really, because we live in an era that is so defined to such a large degree by science, is that historically the great advances have not come from within the field of science, but rather from philosophy. And let me explain that when there's a question which is very difficult to answer, in which there's all kinds of different proposals out there, and is a very revolutionary question, usually what happens is that the way toward the answer is formulated by someone from the field of philosophy. For example, Aristotle, just had these speculations or thoughts about motion, for example, and he said that because of his the way he looked at it, a heavier object would fall at a faster than a lighter object, and as long as this was entirely in a philosophical point of view, where it was unverifiable, there was no real way of getting the answer. But then along came Galileo, and Galileo did not call himself a scientist. As a matter of fact, that phrase was formed coined much later. Galileo called himself a natural philosopher, as did Newton also called himself a natural philosopher. And the reason for this long doctoral dissertation that I just came up with there is a very real point, and that's that we've got to leave open the possibility that the initial breakthrough in this question of life after death will not come from scientific thinking, but rather from conceptual thinking. And let me predict that that is probably what will happen, that the initial breakthrough into genuine rational comprehension of the question of life after death will not be initially scientific, but rather it will be a conceptual or philosophical breakthrough that will lead to new rational means of investigation. And I suspect that that's what will happen. That said, let me go back again to this question of out-of-body experiences and so on. And one context in which an out-of-body experience does often occur is in the context of a near-death experience, but there are other contexts as well. For example, apparently it's a fairly common experience that astronomers gazing through their telescopes will suddenly find themselves out of their bodies, looking at themselves from above, or classical musicians playing great music on stage may find themselves suddenly out of their body, looking down from above, and indeed having spiritual experiences. I have a friend, Eric Pagani, who's both a psychologist and a well-known concert pianist, who first told me about this experience in 1988, that playing a beautiful piece of music, he suddenly found himself out of his body and in this light, and yet played the piece very beautifully. So there are other things in addition to being near death that can bring about this experience of being out of their body. Another thing, as I give instances of in Glimpses of Eternity, is that I hear lots of cases of people who are just standing there at the bedside of their dying loved one, and as the person in the bed dies, the person standing beside may simultaneously leave their body and accompany their dying loved one partway toward this light.
Okay, back to the phones we go. It's Tammy's turn, El Reno, Oklahoma, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Tammy. Hi.
Okay, first I have a question for Raymond about a book to see if you know, ever read it.
All right.
And then a shared death experience. The book is Voices from the Edge of Eternity by John Myers, 1968.
Well, no, I haven't.
Well, that has over, well, I'd say it's got probably at least 200 shared death experiences going all the way back. It's got all the way back to like Anne Boleyn, the 1500s. And
oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. And please tell me again that name of that book.
Voices from the Edge of Eternity by John Myers, 1968.
Voices from the Edge of Eternity. Thank you so much, by John Myers.
And
thank
my my great-grandfather, my mom's dad, was when I think this girl was like 17 or 18 years old, was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that she was saying, first of all, my feet are so hot. They're just hot. And as it went on, you know, it took like probably half an hour or so she died. But by the end, she was screaming, my feet are on fire. I'm going in the fire. Please pull me out.
Jeez.
Oh, my.
All right. Thanks for that.
Well, thank you. Voices from the Edge of Eternity. Thank you.
What projects, John, are you and Raymond working on?
Well, you know, someone can view these if they go to my blog from my website, but there are several. And one of the most important projects is a TV series called, what will start next year, called Proof Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, in which we'll discuss all of the various aspects of this afterlife. And this series is expected to run at least 5 years, George.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, but we want to begin with consciousness. Now, that's going to be a tough cookie, because I don't know if anyone can say for sure what it is, but we're going to try to explain it the best we can, because everything else, reincarnation, out of the body, shared death experience, everything follows from that consciousness and how to explain it. And I think you mentioned earlier something important, George, that, you know, we're not aware of this four-dimensional life in which we live. And if I might just say quickly, this goes back to Olpensky's essay called The Fourth Dimension of Time. And he says in that essay, we live in three dimensions, and only part of us knows about this greater dimension. So we are in a four-dimensional world. We're starting to learn that, and I think this series will do that. Also, Raymond is involved with me in a project, a film project. One is called Spirit, and the other is called Proof, which will be eventually done in 3D. And trailers are up on through my website blog. They can click on that and see these trailers, along with the work of Nick Mendoza and Diane Duff, which is a little different. It's called Quantum Wisdom, but this film should be out by Christmas of 2011.
A lot of projects, John.
We're excited.
Who's the venue for the TV show? Who's going to air it?
Well, that's something I can't mention yet, because
okay,
it's right in the contract signing phase.
Okay.
But soon we'll know.
All right, good luck to you there. Next up, we go to Strongville, Ohio. Mike's turn on the wild card line. Go ahead, Michael.
Good evening, George, John, and Raymond.
Hi.
Oh, good evening, Mike.
George, in response to Joy Pugh, maybe you could have on Dr. John Lash. He has a book called Failed God, something to consider. Raymond and John, if the brain is possibly a receiver and a transmitter, in consideration that an NDE is possibly a brain chemistry phenomena, I wanted to mention that the hippies of the 1960s had a term called, when tripping, a contact buzz or a contact high, where the people not tripping on acid or mushrooms would feel the mild effect of those who were tripping or changed their brain chemistry in their presence. And maybe possibly an example of how brain chemistry augmentation could affect the brain as a transmitter?
Want to take that, John, maybe?
Okay,
we have
30
seconds, and we'll come back.
Good question, Michael. You know, and recently I've been watching, you know, that movie Hair, thinking about those days and all these things, right? The thing is, Michael, you know, this brain chemistry that you mentioned, you know, and we talked earlier about ketamine and DMT, And this chemical reaction may not explain what's really going on. I think what explains more of what you're saying could be the mirror neurons that Dr. Moody mentioned. And this goes back to the 1980s when these were first discovered in monkeys, where a single neuron was monitored. And as the monkey was reaching for food, they would record this, and this was the experiment. But they noticed that if this monkey watched a human being or another monkey reach for food, this neuron was activated.
John, let's come back and talk more about the brain and chemistry in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John, let's get back to you wrapping up the brain chemistry section here we were talking about. Go ahead.
Yes, when Michael had asked this question, and I have to say, for me, this is the first contact high I've heard about just being next to someone using chemicals or something like that. As you know, I'm in Hawaii, George, and there's a lot of that goes on with marijuana, which is very common here. I can understand that kind of a contact. But as far as chemicals of the brain, the one thing I want to mention is that, you know, Aldous Huxley and his perceptions of consciousness and this altered states with mescaline and all these things, you know, I've got to say it's not a safe thing or a wise thing to do. And let me tell you why. Once a good friend of mine in Cincinnati called me long distance to say this. Doctor, he said, how much of our brains do we use? And he said, don't they tell us we use 10% of our brain? And I said, well, I don't know about you folks in Ohio, but here in Hawaii, we use all of our brain. So we always joke about that. But we do use most of our brain all the time. We're just not aware of how important the substance is, and we can't adulterate it with drugs. So the same man asked me the same question years later. He said, doctor, do you still drink? Because when he was in the Marine Corps and I was in the Navy, we were young guys, and we would go out drinking, as young guys do. But I said, yes, I might drink a glass of wine or two. That's kind of healthy for the body. And he said, well, why would you want to change what's in its best state when it's not affected by anything, talking about the human brain? So I would say what these drugs can do, if I can get on a quick soapbox, is they kind of change these filters that the brain has, and they kind of lessen these barriers, and they allow us to assess these other dimensions, but it's not always a wise thing to do. So, Michael, I don't think the chemical thing has ever been proven that causes these experiences that Raymond talks about, the near-death and shared-death experiences. They're quite different from the chemically induced experiments, which show some of the aspects are there, but not the key ones, such as the life review and the life-changing situation. So that would be my thought on the chemical thing.
And Raymond, are most people above board with their near-death experiences, in your opinion?
Well, I think so. And, you know, I talked to a lot of people shortly after the event. For example, some years ago, I was a consultant from a group of cardiologists who got interested in this. And because they had a patient that they greatly respected who came back with a near-death experience. So this cardiology group got interested and would have me come and talk with their patients who had recently been resuscitated. And, you know, when you're sitting there beside the bed of a person who's just recently, you know, been brought back from the brink of death, this particular group's patients were a large percentage of them were, you know, businessmen, hard-driving business people in their 50s and so on, who had lived a sort of compulsive lifestyle and, you know, hard-driving people. And, you know, when you see a person like that relating an experience shortly after it happens and you see the tears and the emotionality, you know, the idea abstractly that they might be making this up sort of dissolves. You know, a lot of the so-called skeptics, as I said, who aren't really skeptics at all, but nonetheless, a lot of people who say that, oh, you know, this is obviously people being emotional, or they're there at the bedside of a dying loved one, and of course they're overwhelmed by emotions. Well, mostly this is just sort of armchair people who are sitting there and imagining what things must be like in a situation that they most of them have zero experience with. And I, dealing with the terminally ill has been part of my
therapy,
medical experience, yeah, from the very beginning. I, you know, just from the very beginning that I got into medicine, I this was something that was very important with me and my experience of being with the terminally ill and being there with families as loved ones pass away. It's not like you might think of in the movies with people yelling and screaming and all beside themselves and so on. The normal course of events really is that when the death actually does occur, it's almost a relief to people, and things go along very with a surprising lack of overwhelming emotions. Death is, after all, a natural part of life. And it's something that I think the deathbed scene is not like people who are not clinically experienced might imagine it.
All right, let's go to Dunedin, Florida. We've got Adam, first-time caller. Go ahead, Adam.
Pleasure to speak with you.
Sure thing.
My buddy, my best friend, he had like been messing with a lot of drugs, and he decided to drink a lot of cough syrup, so he ended up overdosing. Oh. And while he was in the hospital, he said that he had an OBE that he lifted out of his body, and he was looking down at himself, watching all the doctors run around frantically trying to, you know, get all the drugs out of his system. So I wondered, does taking drugs or anything have anything to do with having an out-of-body experience? Or
go ahead, John. I'll let you take that.
Well, yeah, Adam, I would say this. Maybe he was having a near-death experience. You said he overdosed, right? And they had to be resuscitated. So I would put that in the category of near-death. But I wouldn't say that that type of extreme condition is any different than a cardiac arrest due to a heart problem, or maybe a traumatic problem that puts a person at a cardiac standstill. I think that near-death experience is kind of independent of that. Wouldn't you think so, Raymond?
Absolutely. And obviously, in some of the cases of near-death experiences, drugs are involved that are given by the physicians, for example, for therapeutic purposes. But we have many cases of near-death experiences in which no drugs were administered. So whether there is or is not medication involved in the situation, there may or may not be near-death experiences. So the administration of drugs is not the cause of near-death experiences. It may be something a given patient may have received drugs who then goes on to have a near-death experience, but then so do we also have lots of patients who have near-death experiences of the same kind, and yet medication was not involved.
Are there different types of shared experiences, Raymond?
Well, yes, they are, and they vary in the same way that there are different types of near-death experiences, in that what seems to happen is that there are a variety of common experiences. For example, people at the bedside may say that they themselves lift out of their bodies when a loved one dies, or they may say that they see the spirit of the deceased person rise up from the body and go away, or they may talk about seeing a beautiful light. They may talk about hearing this beautiful music. They may experience the change of geometry in the room. They may empathically co-live the panoramic life review of the person who passes away. And what we find is that there is a gradation or a spectrum effect. That is, a single individual may have one or two of these things, or four or five of these things, or the whole spectrum. spectrum of the experience. And so they vary in that way. That is that they have the common elements, but not every person may have the whole full-blown experience, but only elements of it. And I've had quite a number of cases, too, in which people report the whole thing. So they tend to vary in that way.
Let's go to Rodlene in Concrete, Washington on the wildcard line. Hi, Rodlene.
Hi, everyone.
Hey.
Hello. Hi. Well, I have a story about a shared death experience that happened 17 years ago. I was 17 at the time, and I was on the train from Florida to Chicago on my way back to California. And I met a woman, and she was an older woman, and she sat with me on the train, and she told me about her 17-year-old granddaughter that had gotten in a car wreck on a windy road, and how sad she was, and we cried. I cried with her about her 17-year-old because she was my age. And later that night, when we got to Chicago, there was two big tornadoes that came through Chicago, and it caused a lot of havoc, and the trains were late, and I got into some sort of an altered state and was writing in my journal, and I wrote all kinds of things. And a few days later, when I got to Lompoc, California, I got a call. This was before cell phones, and I got a call that one of my dear friends from school had died in a car wreck that very same night. She'd been thrown from a car on a very windy road up in the Cascade Mountains. Her name is Cassie Hutchison. And I had written in my journal, I went back to read it, and it was all that I had shared this experience. I was as if I was talking like I was her, like I was there with her, and I was saying, I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready. And the light was comforting me, and I was going toward the light. And I ended up having a dream that night after I realized that she had died and it was her, that she was risen above the Cascade Mountains, and she was with Jesus Christ and Krishna and all of these saints and beautiful faces. And that's exactly what she was. She was just a beautiful soul.
Now, these experiences that people share, Raymond, what creates it? Is there some spirit guide that does this, that pushes it?
You know, George, I don't know, but I really want to find out. I mean, it's what you tend to do, I think, is to look at the first level of trying to explain this in some sort of psychological way, but the difficulty really is that I think that some of the basic concepts of psychology, although they may seem a little more familiar because we use them more commonly, for example, even consciousness, as John was talking about, we all have direct awareness of our own consciousness. So in that sense, it's familiar, or we may talk about the unconscious or the preconscious or whatever. But we are really dealing with concepts here that are very, very fuzzy. I mean, what is consciousness? And if we think that we know, then all that's a sign is that obvious that we haven't thought very deeply about it, because really the question of the relationship between the mind and the body, or the mind of the brain, goes all the way back to Pythagoras. He was probably the first person to...
He's the numerologist of his time, huh?
That's right. That's right. And this mind-body problem is, I'm sure John will agree, just this is the big mystery. How is our direct inner experience of consciousness, how is that related to the body? And the real answer is, we don't know. John sort of alluded to Wilder Penfield, and one thing I've seen, and I'm sure John has seen this too, I can just tell you from this is just the way it occurs in medicine. And that is, over the course of your career, when you're young, you'll see these young scholars, the young neuroscientists, for example. I had a good friend, when I was in graduate school in philosophy, I had a good friend who was starting out in the neurosciences, and David and I used to have these debates about, oh yeah, you know, David would say, well, you know, we're right around the corner. Pretty soon, the mystery of consciousness will be resolved, and it's all in the neurons and the electrochemicals and so on. And I would say, no, David, I don't think so. You know, I mean, this is a big one. It's a long, long way till the discovery of the nature of consciousness and so on. Well, yeah, we had this friendly debate over and over constantly for a long period of time. Well, about, I guess it was 15 years ago, David invited me to the medical school where he was a professor of neurosciences or worked in the neurosciences. And I remember when we got to his office, he poked his head out of his office and he had this big smile on his face and he said, well, Raymond, you were right. And that's what tends to happen to people in the neurosciences, is that early in their life they have this great optimism that we're right around the corner to determining the mystery of consciousness. And then as we grow older, reality dawns on us that this is a huge problem. And I think that these empathic death experiences, you know, they may really help us with this. I don't know yet, but what is this that some sort of transcendental consciousness seems to be co-lived, that it's as though, and here I'm talking entirely in metaphors, I realize, but it's as though death is a kind of window into something else.
Well, and there's no doubt.
That some sort of trans-dimensional consciousness can be precipitated or brought about or opened up by the death of someone, and it doesn't have to pertain just to the person who dies, but it can somehow spread out to people who are around or even who are across, you know, several states away. It's amazing.
Death could merely be the portal, Raymond.
It is. I mean, a portal is a good analogy here, that death seems to open up some sort of portal into some other state of existence.
Absolutely. Raymond, we're out of time. Dr. John Turner, both of you, thank you so much. Dr. Raymond Moody, Dr. John L. Turner, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Their websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well, so if you just need to go and look at some of the incredible things they've worked on, go ahead. And we've been talking about Raymond's book, Glimpses of Eternity. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.